Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and that was Chatham County Line singing Birmingham Jail. And we'll be hearing a lot of songs dedicated to the bombing, the people who were killed in the bombing in Birmingham, Alabama, 50 years ago. It was 50 years ago on a Sunday, and yesterday was 50th anniversary of that date, if you can call it an anniversary, and that was also on a Sunday. And we want to remember Addie Mae Collins, Carol Robertson, Denise McNair, and Cynthia Wesley, who were the four little girls who were killed in that bombing. A bomb put there by the white supremacist Ku Klux Klan on the 16th Baptist, Shoot Baptist Church, which had become a meeting ground for the movement in Birmingham, Alabama. 63 other people were injured on that day. A little girl lost her eye that day. Two other young black men were killed in the streets of Alabama that day, Johnny Robinson, who was only 16, and Virgil Ware, who was only 13, shot dead by the police as African-Americans stood up that day protesting protesting what happened, protecting the church in confrontations with police and racists. Two little boys were also killed in that day. Their names shouldn't be forgotten. It was a day when the then Governor George Wallace was really the man who incited that. He incited it because he made this comment about stopping those who were fighting segregation. He said, "We need a couple of first-class funerals," is what he said in a speech to the people of Alabama. And Ku Klux Klan leader Robert Chambliss took that to heart, and he placed those bombs in the 16th Street Baptist Church, 122 pounds of dynamite. And he was found not guilty of murder. And that wasn't the first episode in Birmingham, Alabama. Alabama was a violent place. Already 16 churches had been bombed in the state of Alabama before this happened. Civil rights workers had been killed. Black folks standing up for the rights had been murdered. Demonstrations took place in Birmingham, Alabama, with Bull Connor sicking dogs on people and fire hoses on people. Children went to jail in the Children's Crusade of Birmingham, Alabama. Our own Freeman Hrabowski, president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, was one of those children. And it was to give people a sense at that moment, this was a moment of huge violence. People don't understand how violent it was, how life-threatening it was for people to stand up for their rights at that time in Alabama. And 50 years ago yesterday, that church was bombed. And once again, we're going to spend this day and all of our breaks remembering Addie Mae Collins, Carol Robertson, Denise McNair, and Cynthia Wesley, four innocents who were murdered that day, 63 others injured. Almost all the men who did it walked away except for one. In 1977, he was finally brought to justice by the then Bill Blixley, who was Attorney General for Alabama, and was sentenced to life in prison, where he died there in 1985. Some semblance of justice was had. We're going to put on our website piece that was written in the Modern American Poetry magazine about the 1963 Birmingham bombing. I encourage you all to go to our website after the show and read it. We'll link to it. It's an incredible history of that moment that you all need to see and read. We'd spend more time on that today, but we have a lot of things to talk about, and I want you to just remember those four little girls, the two young men who were killed, and what happened that day in Birmingham, Alabama, 50 years ago yesterday on a Sunday morning in somebody's church. This day in history, let's go through it quickly so we can jump into our conversation with our guests who are all assembled here. This day was Independence Day, 1810, Mexico's independence from Spain. And one of those things that's so important about that day is that that was also when black folks were freed from slavery in Mexico, way before America, United States of America ever thought about it. This was the day that in 1874 that Ricardo Flores Magnon was born. Now, you may not know him. Most people don't in America. He was a Mexican revolutionary whose work began the Mexican Revolution that happened in the early part of the 20th century. John Hendricks, the great singer, Lambert Hendrickson Bavon, or Ross later, was born this day in 1921. Lauren Bacall, one of my favorite actors of all time, was born on this day in 1924, as was Charlie Byrd in 1925. And we'll be hearing some of this music coming up in a couple of hours, in the next couple of hours. Ripley King was born on this day in Benham, Mississippi, 1925. Ripley King? Who is Ripley King? B.B. King. 88 years old today and still playing. Still has his own radio show and still jamming. This is also a day in 1950 that Henry Louis Gates was born. So this is a day in 1973 when Victor Jara was killed. Victor Jara was a Chilean songwriter, singer, poet, theater man, actor, director, who was part of the revolution in Chile when the Americans and others had a CIA plot, overthrew Salvador Allende, and this man of peace died on this day, was murdered, shot dead with 44 machine gun bullets, riddled through his body, thrown into the streets, so people see what he had done to him, what would happen to them. And his songs of love, peace, and social justice were a contradiction to the brutal way that he was murdered on that day, but we always remember Victor Jara. Mary Travers was born on this day, died on this day in 2009 from cancer, Peter, Paul, and Mary, of a great folk singing trio. This is a day in 1810 that Father Miguel Hidalgo begins Mexicans' fight for independence from Spain in this year. This is the year in 1848 the French abolished slavery in all of its territories. And this is the years that 1893 that settlers made a land run, prime land on the Cherokee Strip in Oklahoma. Indians moved out once again. And who have seen? We always say the American government gives nothing to people. It's all their own sweat and equity. Mm-hmm. Well, they took this land and gave it to people. Said, it's yours now for free. And people took it in 1893. This is the day in 1908 that General Motors was founded. This is the day in 1920 the Wall Street bombing took place where 38 people were killed and 400 injured. Where revolutionaries bombed Wall Street to protest Sacco and Vanzetti, but to protest what Wall Street was doing to the America and the world. It's interesting that happened on this day, not suggesting we should do that at all. But this is also the day 5 years ago that Lehman Brothers started to go under and the United States decided to bail it out. Not to bail our people out, but bail it out. In 1928, over 3,000 African-Americans died at Lake Okeechobee when the flood happened in western Palm Beach, Florida, a 15-foot tidal wave. There were three mass graves there right now. People just dumped into the graves. No markers, no identification. Just a lot of dead black folks dumped into graves, unmarked, on that day in 1928. 1941, this is when, World War II, that Reza Pahlavi, the Shah, was thrown out of his office, had his son put in place because he was about to sign a deal with the Nazis, and the British and the Soviet Union went in and took him out. This is the day in 1971 that six Klansmen were arrested in connection with bombings of 10 school buses in Pontiac, Michigan to stop integration. This is the day in 1982 that the massacres at the Shabra and Shatila refugee camps in Lebanon took place. 3,000 people were killed on that day. By the Shiites and Palestinians, by a Lebanese Christian militia, but what came out later was that this was they did do the killing, but the Israeli Defense Forces surrounded that camp and allowed the phalangists to do this mass murder when they knew it was taking place. In 1983, an Israeli Kahan Commission appointed to investigate the incident found the Israeli military personnel were aware there was a massacre going on, it's a day that lives in infamy in history. In 1987, the Montreal Protocol was signed to protect the ozone layer from depletion. This day in 1991 is when deposed Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega began his trial in the United States. He did our bidding, then we put his butt in jail. And then in 2007, this is the day that mercenaries working for Blackwater Worldwide shot and killed 17 Iraqis in Nisour Square, Baghdad. That led to increased escalations of violence in that country. So that was this day in history. Not the happiest day in history, but one that we wanted to share with you all. We now turn our attention to Baltimore. We now turn our attention to Baltimore City and the curfew. We have with us here in the studio Councilman Brandon Scott, Baltimore City Council member representing the 2nd District, Vice Chair of the Public Safety Committee, who supports this bill. And the mayor, good to have you back, Brandon.
Thank you, sir.
I always appreciate your willingness to come in here and do battle and conversation on this program. It means a lot. Sonia Kumar is with us, staff attorney for the ACLU of Maryland. Good to have you back in the studio, Sonia.
Thanks for having me.
Jason Tache is with us for the first time. Tache, right?
Correct.
And Juvenile Justice Policy Director for Advocates for Children and Youth. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having us.
My old friend and colleague, Dante Wilson, is in the studio, CEO and founder of Reclaiming Our Children Community Project. Good to have you in the studio.
Good morning, Mr. Mark.
And David Brown's with us, aide to City Councilman Carl Stokes, and a political figure and leader in his own right. Good to have you in the studio. And
thank
a host
you,
here on WEA as well.
Yes.
And all of you at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888. Candy, I see the first caller up. We're going to come to your call in just a few minutes. So be a little patient. When I get to our guests, you let them have their say. And then all you, please leap in with your thoughts. Only fair to start with Brandon.
Well, great, Mark.
Tell us why you support.
Well, I introduced this bill simply. This is about common sense. And I think that what I said the first time when I spoke to my colleagues about this, that it's an embarrassment that they in 1995 and in 2006 said it was okay for our young children to be on the street by themselves, no matter what their age is, at 11 p.m. during the school night, when we know that they have to be up, most of them, by 6 to be functional in class the next day. But more instead, that this is just, for me, bringing our curfew up current to make sure that our kids are not only protected and safe. Everyone wants to make this about public safety and crime, but also so that they're ready for school the next day and to keep them off the streets when they don't have any business out there. If anyone can find a reason for a five-year-old to be outside 11 o'clock by themselves, please show me. There isn't one. There isn't one. I know that when I grew up here in the 90s, when this city was at its lowest point in the history of Baltimore City, I knew that in Park Heights, if that street light came on and my butt wasn't in the house, I wouldn't be sitting down for a couple hours because my dad said, I don't care if the city's curfew is 11 o'clock. Your curfew is 9 o'clock because y'all have to go to school tomorrow. You have to sleep. You have to get ready. You have to make sure that you eat to go to school the next day. This is what this is about. We're not going to be we don't arrest kids for curfew. We're going to enforce it the same way that we do today. They need to do better at that. We're not – the parents – one of the key things in this legislation is that myself and the police want to divert these things away from the court. We want to send these people to the family tree, to the Center for Urban Youth and Families, so that they can understand what kind of harm's way they're putting their young people in. We don't want to arrest people. We don't collect the money, and we don't want to collect the money because we don't want them to go to court. This is not a criminal thing. It should not be in the criminal court. This is something that should be handled in the community.
Sonia, and you were one of the first people quoted as questioning the efficacy of this.
Right. So, I mean, first of all, I want to commend Councilman Scott for his concern for kids. I think everybody in this room, everybody in the city wants kids to be safe. The question is, how do we do that? And I think one of the points I want to draw out is that police already have the authority to step in when they perceive a child to be in danger. And of course, the curfew proposal doesn't just apply to five-year-olds. It applies to all kids under 17. But the overall concern is really just sort of if we're looking at what makes kids safe, a lot of research has been done at curfews, and they've really been shown to not be particularly effective at reducing the victimization of children. Children are more likely to be harmed by somebody they know than by a stranger, as we know. And in fact, in Maryland, we have this quirky law that requires jurisdictions on the Eastern Shore to study curfews before they introduce them. And every jurisdiction, and the goal being to understand whether the proposal will actually achieve its purposes. And every study that's been done, I think the law's been on the books for almost 15 years, has concluded that the curfew will not achieve the goals it's purported to do. And so the other thing I want to get at is while the intention may not be to arrest young people, the truth is that increasing, one of the issues that comes up with curfews is that they're sort of very difficult to enforce even-handedly, and it's impossible to prevent situations from escalating into. So one of the things that I've heard from young people, for example, relates to not the kids who make it to the curfew center, for example, but the kid for whom the interaction escalates before it gets to the point of the curfew center. The point is fair that we already have a curfew on the books. I think my concern, that doesn't mean that we need to sort of move it up, is that, now we have a situation where after 9 p.m., police have the a basis for stopping and asking for ID and proof of age for anyone they perceive to be young. Right? Anyone who could arguably be
under the age of 14.
Under the age of 14 after 9 p.m., and that's year-round. And that creates its sort of its own set of problems. But the other sort of, I think, really important point that I just want to touch on is that what we're doing is we're really taking away public spaces from young people. And that at the same time that we've been shutting down rec centers and depriving, you know, not providing sufficient opportunities for young people to play safely in sort of in protected areas, we're now saying that they can't be outside. And there are other ways, I think, to help make kids safer, help make sure they're ready for school without the curfew.
I'm going to try to get around this room here before we have to go to break here. Dante.
So having a curfew law is, in my opinion, it's some good with it, it's some bad with it. In the past, I have seen in West Baltimore where police officers intentionally go to arrest young people. You know, for example, a child may be across the street from their house, and because the parent wasn't present and things of that nature, the police officer still apprehended the young person. Also, in addition to charging these families with fees or fines because of what's going on, I think it has to be looked at through a different lens. I think it has to be looked at through family investment. And when I state family investment, I'm not just talking about referring them to Family Tree to help parents, but what is the family dynamics? And the reason I'm saying that, because part of our program is psychiatric rehabilitation program, and when I do a lot of assessment, there are so many people in transitional homes. There are so many people in different situations that it may be a reason. I don't want a 10-year-old on the streets late night because anything could happen, but do we really understand the dynamics of what may be taking place, and how do we work with that? How do we monitor that? Even taking them to a center, is the center being manned by police officers, or are social workers being a part of that process so we can begin to provide prevention and intervention services? And so instead of saying, here's a fine for $500, do that parent have substance abuse issue? Let's be real, be real when we talk about the family dynamics. A lot of parents don't have the boundaries and structure to put in place for their young people. And so when you have a family dynamic that's like that, it's not that the parent want the child on the street after hours, but this may be something that takes place. And then we apprehend a young person. We want to put them in the court system and different things of that nature. When I say court system, we're talking about that fine towards that parent. And when we look at the median income for Baltimore City, the majority of people are below poverty anyway. So whatever fine we try to apply to parents, the reality is majority of them can't afford it. So we add an additional stress. We create an additional impairments, which contributes to mental illness. So I think we need to look at it from a diverse perspective instead of just saying that we're going to get young people off the streets.
And so let me go to David Brown. And let me just say that Dante Wilson is also a therapist and a social worker who runs the Center for Family and Children's here on the east side of town, and we'll talk about that in a bit as well.
Well, Mark, let me just say, I commend Councilman Scott for what he's trying to do to make sure that kids are off the street and in the proper place during the proper time. However, there is an issue here because I can recall during the Clinton administration, which is probably the era in which Councilman Scott grew up in, they put in the omnibus crime bill. That crime bill took African-American kids off the streets. It gave most of them a black mark against their records, and it fueled the criminal justice enterprise. After that, we had another policy that came through Baltimore entitled, locking up kids and what was the name of that policy?
Zero tolerance.
That's it. Yes, you all know exactly what I'm talking about. Zero tolerance came through, and it really fueled the fire for young juveniles to all have records placed against them, many of which call our office on a regular basis trying to get expungements on their records for minuscule crimes, meaningless crimes such as, loitering or standing on the street corner or sitting on the steps. And then also now, then we had the curfew because we went through this era where we had 300 murders a year, over 300 murders a year in Baltimore. So, okay, I understand getting people off the streets and netting them with zero tolerance for the larger issues, trying to look for more of the nuisance crimes. But now we're talking about another curfew. This time we got places like Harbor Point, Harbor Place, Harbor East, that's all under places where young people go, places where young people need to hang out, and places where seemingly young people were allowed to participate, now they're not going to be down there. They're going to make sure that they're off the streets. And they raised the fines from $300 to $500. It's fee-driven now. That's what it seems like to me, because I didn't understand the increase. I mean, I could understand the change in the hours, but I didn't understand the increase in the fines. And so it's making for a bad situation. And I wish I could say that they were going to be targeting areas all across the city, like Mount Washington and Roland Park and Upper Park Heights and those areas. And we saw what happened with the Shumrud case. They're going to be targeting areas where young people are sitting on their steps and outside because, they don't have families. I mean, if you can remember the Wire situation where this gentleman, Dookie, would come out and he would feed all the kids in the morning and send them off to school for their breakfast because they just didn't have families that were capable. I support a young man right now that both of his parents are on crack cocaine, and he played football. He goes to St. Francis Academy. But he had no family structure. This guy could have been lost on the streets, but he had both the academics and the athletic prowess to move forward, and he's there. But we have to be on him constantly because he doesn't like structure. He's never had it. And we got too many kids in the city like that.
So, Jason, let me let you take us to break here, and then we're going to open the phones and have this next 50 minutes of a real roundtable. Please jump in and say what you have to say. But please, Jason, go ahead.
Thanks, Mark. I think that the mayor and Councilman Scott are talking about the right problem, but they're proposing the wrong solution. At the end of the day, the numbers just don't back up that curfew laws work. If you look to BCPD's numbers alone, juvenile arrests at night are only 12% of all arrests in Baltimore City this year. I mean, that means that kids aren't out committing crimes at night. The victimization isn't happening at night. The kids are committing crimes after school. That's statistically true in Baltimore, and that's statistically true nationwide. The solution has to go after idleness, not that kids are out late at night. Home visitation programs are a better alternative to extending curfew. Reopening closed rec centers at times when kids are actually active and actually committing crimes would mean that children would commit crimes at a lower rate. I think that's what Baltimore City needs to be looking at.
We're going to take a very brief break and come back right to Candy. First caller up, and then let everybody go at it here about what we just heard. 410-319-8888. Curfews in Baltimore City, is it the right thing? Are there alternatives? Stay with us. We'll be right back. Was Richard Farina, his original song, Birmingham Sunday, which was sung by a lot of people. The number here is 410-319-8888. We're here with David Brown, aide to Councilman Carl Stokes, and political figure in the city, Dante Wilson, CEO and founder of Reclaiming Our Children and Community Project, who runs the Collington Square Rec Center with a lot of programs inside there. Jason Tashia, Juvenile Justice Policy Director for Advocates for Children and Youth. Sonia Kumar, Staff Attorney for the ACLU of Maryland. And Councilman Brandon Scott, who represents the 2nd District and is the Vice Chair of the Public Safety Committee. And we're talking curfew legislation, 410-319-8888. Candy, you're on the air.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Candy.
Good morning.
Good. Actually, I am totally in support of Brandon Scott's legislation, Councilman Scott. And just to give a quick identification of myself, I am a single mother of a 16-year-old and a 10-year-old here in Baltimore City. I also formerly ran the Shutdown Academy and Carpenter House with former retired NFL player Keon Carpenter here in Baltimore. So we mentored about 200 or more children and understanding the need of those children in and around Baltimore City. First, I think that the only way that we're going to identify the issue with our youth is to gain a proper relationship with the city and the families. I think that from what I've read with this legislation is that it's putting the responsibility back into the family's hand, the parent's hand, has nothing to do with putting it on the police to have the police mistreat our children or anything like that. If, in fact, you know, piggybacking off of what Dante said, if there is any issues that are, and we know that there are around the city with some, maybe some negative interaction with the youth and the police department, I think that this will, some of the people are going to comply with the, with the curfew, so which means we're going to pull some of the kids off the street, and then we'll have some time to deal with the issues with the ones that are out there. You know, in our program, if it weren't for us telling the kids that they needed to be in by a certain time in order to play, and our program goes from March to January, a lot of them don't have some of that directional positive parenting that would make them, you know, be in and be responsible for the next day. If we didn't exist, they'd be out here in the street. Another thing, I heard the gentleman mention the Shamron case, which I think is apples and oranges. Number one, that happened during the day. The idea of this legislation is to keep people off the street after hours, and I just could not imagine, you know, why we would be opposed to that idea. Also, Dante mentioned about, you know, us having issues with locking up the kids. I think that, you know, back in, I know when I was growing up, and I'm 36, I'm 37 years old, we used to have a neighborhood parent, and that parent would make you go in the house if you weren't supposed to be out and doing things after hours and things that you weren't supposed to. Unfortunately, we don't have that anymore. So we do need something in place, and I do believe that, you know, that allows even for a parent to reach out and say, you know, I just need some interaction to see where this child needs to be. If there are other issues, then directing them to programs. I don't look at this legislation as something to beat up and attack the kids, but rather gaining some type of bond and communication between the family, the city, yes, the police department. The police department, all police aren't bad. You know, and I think that that is a terrible stigma that has been placed, you know, on Baltimore City. All police officers are not bad. So it gives that communication to maybe get it back to the way that it used to be in the 70s and 80s when I was young.
Okay.
And also, if I could just quickly add in the young lady that made the comment in regards to the rec. Again, I think that that's irrelevant. The rec centers are not open after 9, 10 o'clock at night. The idea is to have these kids in the house, ready and getting themselves prepared for school the next day. And I can't see there being an issue with that at all.
All right. Thank you so much. Let me very quickly go around this table, respond to Candy. And Brandon, you can, and please jump in, everybody.
Well, I think that she made some very good points, and I just like
them. I'm sure you do.
But just to point out a few
go
things.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
One, if everybody in the room knows, and David knows this, I'm actually right now trying to lead efforts to get more funding for the Department of Recreation and Parks. Part of that is to have more late-night programming in the summertime, like midnight basketball, those kind of things, et cetera, which – or are the kids going to be exempt from the curfew? But with that being said, not every child is going to go to the rec center. You know, we still have to make sure not every kid is going to go to the rec center. Not every kid is going to come to a teen night at Collington Square. Not every kid is going to go to midnight basketball at Dunbar. But for those young people who are not or do choose not to be in that, we cannot have them roaming the streets. But also I want to go back to about the arresting the kids again. Coming from someone who ran the nighttime curfew center, the police officers, when they came, someone from the mayor's office, like I was there. They know that the kids were not to come there in handcuffs. If they did, they knew what was going to happen to them. They knew they were going to have some discipline. We're not arresting – this is not about arresting the kids. And, again, we talked about the money portion. It's not about the fines because the city doesn't collect the money because the court just throws them out. For me, it's more about getting these kids who are our most vulnerable. It's not about crime. It's not about preventing crime. It's getting our most vulnerable kids off the street so that we can see what's going on in their families so that we can give them to people like Dante, so that we can send them to other organizations. If you're someone like me who spends weekends and nights on the streets of Baltimore after 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, and you see kids, sometimes, as my council colleague, Councilman Mosby, always says, when you see kids in diapers on Pennsylvania Avenue at 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, something's wrong. Something's wrong. And if something happens to that child, the first people they look at are Councilman Mosby and myself and the police.
And I want to agree, yeah, something is wrong. Yeah. But why go through the approach of the now, once again, I support the curfew as long as it has those social human services,
yes, sir,
components that are a part of it. But we pretend like we don't know what's wrong. We know what's wrong. We,
yeah,
know after the late 80s and the early 90s, the crack epidemic. We understand that parents don't have the parenting skills and things of that nature. So we have to provide services for families, and that's part of the problem with Baltimore City. We don't really do any family strengthening type approaches. And so what we do is we come from one lens thinking that we're going to do this curfew, and a child don't have to be in handcuffs. But the fact that you are riding in that paddy wagon or in that police car to get to this center for your parent who may or may not come even pick you up because of the social ills right. that's in that particular household. So we definitely got to look at this situation from a bigger lens so it can be prevention and intervention services.
Amen.
I really agree. I think, but I think there was something that was highlighted in what Candy said, which is we don't have the neighborhood parent anymore. And I actually question that because I've heard about an extraordinary array of people and programs doing amazing work to try to make kids safer. And I think that what we are disagreeing about isn't sort of that those programs and services are needed for kids. We're agreeing about how to disagreeing about how to access them. And my concern is that police are and the criminal justice system in general is not a good access point for services for kids. I think parents should be able to self-refer. What if instead of calling it the curfew center, we called it the Youth and Family Resource Center, and parents could wanting help could
that's
come
funny those because
kids.
We're actually trying to we're talking about calling it a diversion center. And just to go back to Dante's point, Dante, I'm actually well, if you hear me talk, the number one thing I say when we talk about crime in the city, I always say, until we start talking, and David knows this, until we start talking about increased funding for family strengthening training programs, family strengthening and training and the repair of families and communities in Baltimore is the silver bullet for crime. That won't happen. Actually, I'm going to be having a hearing about family strengthening and training programs in the city coming up. But the fact of the matter is that it's not for me. It's a multiple lens. This is is just one way that I want to get at the problem.
Let me go over here, then over here. We have a full bank of callers. We have to get some callers who are calling in as well. Go ahead.
I think Councilman Scott made a point that shows the problem with the curfew currently. He's saying that there's, you know, babies and diapers on Pennsylvania Avenue out at 1, 2 in the morning. Well, the curfew covers that right now. So if we're expanding the curfew, why do we think that enforcement of it is going to be any better? All you're doing is actually expanding limited police resources over a longer period of time. So I'm not quite sure how that's actually going to change with the proposed expansion. Secondly, I think we're right. As everyone has said in here, the police is not the form of contact for social services. We all agree this comes from a social problem. It's not a criminal justice problem. I'd much rather see a bill that had DSS driving around at-risk neighborhoods handing out their cards than seeing police picking up kids and taking them to a curfew center.
You know, I just want to jump in very quickly and just say this, especially for Candy, who said that she was 36. Well, in this day and age, Candy, you could be considered a grandmother if you're not already a grandmother with this day and age, with the kids that are out there. So you have kids having kids primarily, and you can't legislate your way through this situation. You have to come up with the services that you need to provide for the community. The fine that's there, Councilman Scott, I'd love to see that fine be earmarked for recreational programs, after-school programs, those kind of things, to put it back into the services that for the kids that you're trying to survive.
You get called a vote for the plastic bag tax, you'll have his money.
That's a different story. Also, you know, in terms of the PR campaign, I think that worked back during the 70s. You know, it's 11 o'clock. Do you know where your children are? That was a big campaign that went, and people would check and see if their kids were in.
They do that on 45 now.
Yeah, but, I mean, the bottom line is that whose kids are going to be victimized by this program? And I continue to go back to saying, well, she said I mentioned the Shamron case. Well, I said that because of the whole element of stop and frisk. I said it also because of the element of zero tolerance. I mean, that means they can cast a wide net and just stop you for no particular reason and just, you know, check you out. And Councilman Scott, you look relatively young, too. You could be victimized by your own legislation.
I think I know more about being – Dante and I know more about being stopped and frisked in this room than anybody, for sure.
Yes, absolutely.
So one quick question, very quick question.
Yes,
we need to get to the phones here. Judy, your next caller up. Judy, Neil, Ray, in that order. We're coming right to your calls. If as you argue, that most of the cases are not in Mount Washington or Roland Park that you're going to go looking for, but they're in really poor working class neighborhoods in the city where people don't have jobs or they're paid the lowest wages possible, how can you in good conscience raise the fine? But who can, how can, and what happens if the parent can't afford the fine?
Well, that's the thing is, to be honest, this is what I say again. The fine is basically there for fear.
No, but if it's in the law, it's in the law, man.
It's in the law. I understand that. But also, this is for me, this is coming from someone that's grew up poor and black in this town. This is raising the bar of expectation of what people should and should not allow.
But why do you need the fine? Is a direct question. Why do we have to?
It could be the fine or the jail. I didn't want to up the jail.
So we're going to put more people in. So you can't pay the fine. We're going to put parents in jail.
I didn't want it. I just left the jail portion alone. For me, the fine, raising the fine was to send a message
to
say, hey, look.
Will they put liens on your house?
No.
You know,
they don't do that.
Pay the fine?
Again, David, they don't even collect it. They almost all get thrown out of court. The court just throws them right out. And again, this is the whole purpose of it. Everybody's talking about this portion, but no one's talking about the portion where it says that they can choose to go to a family strengthening and training program to avoid any fine. This is why I put that in there, so they would not. And we can amend the fine back to $300 if you want.
Do we think there's a correlation between the amount of young kids on the street and the lack of employment, amount of young kids in the street and the lack of rec centers, lack of young kids?
Well, I'll just listen.
And not putting
I'm
money there?
I'm going to say, this.
We can spend more money on a pier at Harbor Point for a park.
I'm going to say this.
Doing the whole park.
Two things, Mark. You're talking to someone who has no closed rec centers in this district, right? First and foremost. Secondly, let's not eliminate the fact that we're talking about late night hours.
They were closed before you got there, but they are closed rec centers in your district. They were closed before you became councilman.
Well, not in my district. All of them are open. Every last one of them.
I'm gonna pull up the list
last one of them. Pull it up. Let me finish this point. But let's not replace this. And we have to remember that while, of course, I am a product of Baltimore City Rec and Parks. I love Rec and Parks. I'm constantly working on trying to figure out how to give them more money. Let's not pull out the fact that a recreation program, like Dante said, anything is not going to replace that family structure that we need them to have. If you look at Brandon Scott, and you guys can go back and look, go up and look at Andre Tucker. Go up and look at Thurman Brown. Go up and look at Timothy Belcher. These are all my friends that were in my rec center, on my rec center team from them. The only difference between me and them, other than our criminal records and me not having one, is that, like Dante said, they didn't have the family structure. That is the key. We're not going to save them until we understand what's going on with those families, until we empower those families.
Very quickly, Sonia, and then we have to get to the phones.
Right, sure. I mean, I think that there's two things that just keep coming up. One is the late hours. The examples you keep giving are 2 a.m., 1 a.m., but the curfew, of course, starts at 9 p.m., right?
Yeah, because they should be asleep before school. If they're going to sleep at 11 o'clock, they can't wake up.
So the government's going to tell me when I have to put my kids to sleep?
Yeah,
right.
Well, you do already.
That's what you do already.
No. So are you going to allow your sixth grader to be out at 11 o'clock at night on a school night?
It's not the government's business what time my kid goes to bed.
I just want to make another point that I wasn't finished making before I got interrupted.
You didn't answer the question, Mark. Is your sixth grader going to be outside at 11 o'clock when they have to go to school the next day? On a Sunday night? Nobody in this room is going to allow their kid to do that.
I think that something that we're losing here is that we're not just talking about taking kids off the street who are sort of in danger. We're also talking about sort of depriving kids of all sorts of things that are totally reasonable, age-appropriate, developmentally appropriate.
Like going to the movies.
And we're not just talking about doing this in your district, Councilman. We're talking about doing it across the whole city, right?
Going skating with no parent taking them. And by the time they get back home, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. That's my point.
I think there's a point at which
We have to actually really ask if the cure is worse than the disease, and to some degree, I think that that seems, you know, my position would certainly be that is the case here. There's a lot of things that you're proposing to do that I think make a lot of sense. The question is sort of about whether we need to use the police to do it.
So let me open the phones here and come right back to Dante. 410-319-8888. Let's get a couple of calls in here. Judy, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning. I wish to thank everyone for allowing this forum to take place.
Good morning.
But as a parent of a 16-year-old, I have five children, four of which are adults, one is 16 years old. I would be caught up in that dragnet of curfew. However, I stand in support of the curfew. My son says, well, Mom, it's boring in the house. So he wants to be with his friends. In my community, there are no small children. I live in a community with senior citizens and older people. So my son travels out of our community. Yes, I may be accountable for that fine. My situation is I would rather a police officer knock on my door and say, Judy, here's your son. We're going to fine you, or you can go for diversion tactics, or I can get that knock on the door like I did on August the 2nd with homicide standing at my door and says, Judy, your child is dead. I support this curfew 100%. Where I live, if I travel out of my block, just a few blocks, up to Bel Air, Moravia, there are children on skateboards, children on scooters. Those are the children that we need to service. Yes, there may be issues with drugs, but once the children go into the diversion program, we are holding parents accountable for their children. I grew up in a time where streetlights came on, you come in. I raised my children, streetlights come on, you come in. I stand in support again of the curfew. I'm not part of a statistic or a survey or anything. I'm dealing in reality.
Okay, I do want to get some of the callers in here, but Dante, let me have your say, and we'll go to the callers. And I think maybe we should explore another day whether or not sometimes we think there was a day when all that happened, when it didn't always happen. Mm-hmm. There are, and I was a teenager, older than all y'all in this room combined.
Well, we know from your earlier story, the rules were not something that you like, Mark. But go ahead.
There were lots of 16-year-olds, 15-year-olds on the street corner where I grew up, mm-hmm. at Garrison Liberty Heights, Marlborough Junction, out all hours of the night. Mm-hmm. So I'm just saying that we have this mythology that everybody came in after dark. That didn't happen.
Right. It was exactly. It was a different time for you.
It was a different time back then. So, and even back then, you are talking about the time before the crack epidemic.
Right.
You
yes,
know,
right.
So
right.
after that, things has totally changed. And even the young lady giving an example of Bel Air Road in Moravia, for real, that particular area is dangerous. You know, you had the 4x4 that's down the street. That police don't even have the jurisdiction. That's under federal investigation. Murders take place. Dead bodies found inside. You see what I'm saying? But why is the condition, why is the climate and culture like that? It's not based on the children that are outside. It's based on those family dynamics that we never provided. I mean, I don't know if we want to look at it from the lens of criminal justice. Should we look through it through human services? Should we even look at the pot of money? Because we always talk about pot of money, and the money is never there. So maybe we need to look at it through a public health matter, because this is an epidemic.
It's all
that
of
we
the
did.
Above.
Huh?
That's all of,
above. I'm not going to say that it's all of the above, because criminal justice, there's money in locking people up. There's money in detaining people. It's on the New York, the stock exchange and things of that nature. So we can keep it honest from that point of view right there. So that's why we might have to look at a different pot of money, which is a public health, and we could be able to do things a little bit differently when we talk about diversion programs.
So before we go, Sonia, very quick, I have to get these calls in here, but very quickly, Sonia.
Well, first I wanted to say, Judy, I'm very sorry for your loss. I work with a group of moms who have lost their kids to violence, and I think that I think Judy's comment actually speaks to what makes curfew seem so appealing is that they sort of have this intuitive appeal, like we're going to make kids safe, we're going to keep them from dying, we're going to protect them if they're inside. But the research out there just shows that that isn't the case. The other point I just want to make is that in my work doing juvenile justice, I've been looking at sort of historically, you know, what has been done. And the truth is, no matter what era you're in, there are people saying that there's some alarm that kids are less safe now than they ever were before. It is true in every decade. And so I think it's important to have the historical context to how we're looking at what we see before us right now.
Yeah, I agree. But I think they are fueling the criminal justice enterprise, and you can see it every day. When you look at the large disproportion of African-American men who are being locked up continuously, and some of them who have committed major crimes, but most of them who have committed minor crimes, they're in jail. They're in the system, and they have records. And those are the people who will not be able to be productive, who will not be able to get jobs, and who will not be able to move forward.
I want to add something in really quickly.
Very quickly. We've got to get to our callers
here. Something that we're all missing here is that we have to remember that juvenile crime and juvenile victims are at its lowest point in the history of the city of Baltimore.
And only one juvenile murder has taken place when the curfew. They all take place after school.
No, I'm not worried about the curfew. But you didn't hear me saying crime, did you? That didn't come from me. That's a media-driven thing. Right. I didn't say it was about crime.
You did not say that.
Yeah.
You did not say that. I think we should be clear. The 410-319-8888. Neil, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mark. And I'm going to run through my comments and questions real quick here. And as a retired police officer, here are my concerns. Here we have, and we're creating yet another opportunity for negative police and black youth encounters. We've succeeded in lessening the opportunities for positive interaction with the police with the closing of the POW centers. And I'd be interested in learning, Councilman, if POW centers have reopened in your district.
Never closed.
I'm going to go offline once I get through what I have to say, but you can write down the questions.
Go ahead.
And respond afterwards. Thank you for that. Yet, here again, our young kids are learning to run from the police yet again. And we need to create more opportunities for positive interaction between the police and our youth. You know, this is another attempt the police should not be involved in enforcing legislation that's based on morality. Number two, we know the police won't be patrolling Roland Park and similar communities for curfew violators. How does this policy apply to youth in cars, poor kids hang out on corners, affluent kids, like from Roland Park, hang out in cars because they can afford it? And my last piece of my comment, which is a question here, and I think, Mark, you kind of stole some of my thunder here.
Sorry, brother.
As relates to this fine and the paying of the fine, what happens when the parents refuse to pay, can't pay, or refuse to be involved in any of the sanctions that employ? And you mentioned something about the fines won't be enforced or whatever. So here we are creating another unenforceable law, which has no teeth, so therefore it makes no sense to me. So in my closing here, first of all, we have not yet flushed out all the many opportunities and alternatives for identifying vulnerable kids. There are many ways to do that. Some have been mentioned on the show today. And at the end of the day, what we are creating here is another form of oppression for the poor. And Benjamin Franklin has said, and this is related to government, those who sacrifice freedoms for safety deserve neither, and we need to pay particular attention to that, because at the end of the day, what this is about is the freedoms or lack of freedom of our poor, even if they are kids. This is a family issue. We deal with it with the family, not police and criminal justice. Thank you.
410-319-88. A lot of callers. Brandon, you can have a quick thought here.
I just wanted to respond to the Major's question, and thank you again, Major. Major, let's be clear. The Goodnow POW Center, also known as the Goodnow Community Center, never closed. Still open today, and actually is the best rec center in the city of Baltimore. No offense to Dante and what he does. It's great work. But I would put it up against any rec center in the city of Baltimore. But just also to go what he said, again, Major, the law stays the same for children and cars as it did back when you patrol. So it would be no different. You know,
but it would be. Police are not going to stop young white kids who live in Roland Park in Mount Washington for driving a car at 16 years old.
But you got to remember.
But
you got to remember this. Let's remember this, Mark, that actually those kids under the curfew can't be out driving by themselves anyway, because it's illegal for them to do so. When you're on a provisional license, they can't drive.
That's right.
So that's null and void. So that's null and void anyway. So they shouldn't even be driving by themselves legally. So let's. So that's just the truth.
So I think he raised some issues here. I wonder if we are let me just play my argument's sake.
Yep.
What would be the alternatives?
Yeah, who's gonna walk around and get the kids off the street with me? I don't see a lot of people doing that.
I think that there are a lot of people. I think you're being a little bit unfair to the people of Baltimore, Councilman Scott. I mean, I think one of the things I've been sort of struck by is, I think especially like in the last year, there's been this incredible organic movement towards sort of taking back, of people wanting to take back the streets, right? Wanting to make places safer. And there's this crop of people who are doing sort of exactly what we are all saying needs to be done. And so what I wonder is whether a better approach is to identify concrete ways to support those efforts that don't necessarily involve fairly dramatically changing the curfew law in a way that has all these other sort of problematic consequences.
But in addition to that, you have to do it in this separate geographical location, because I know that you're working with Brother Manure in the Pigtown area. So even if you have 300 men, because on the news that look wonderful, 300 men, we could put them all throughout Baltimore. But even with our conversation we had, the focus for those 300 men is that southwest Baltimore area, when you have to go to the different geographical locations, and then we could provide prevention intervention for each, you know, district or each location and things of that nature prior to having this curfew law. There's other alternatives that we can do.
Well, I agree with Dante. And Dante, we do once a month the 300 men go into a different neighborhood.
Once a month. We're talking about things that's happening on a nightly basis.
The hope is to eventually spread those men all out all the time. But I want to bring this point up, though, Mark. And this is something that has been precarious for me.
We have to break here.
Go ahead.
We'll take a short break and come right back. We're going to take this conversation like 10 or 15 minutes. And we'll get your calls. Ray, we're going to get your call. Councilwoman Holton has called in. We'll get to her call as well. 410-319-8888. Stay with us.
Instead of out to play and march the streets of Birmingham in a freedom march today.
Hello, this is Mark Steiner, and welcome back. You're listening to Mark Steiner's show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, and support for WEAA is provided by AAA Mid-Atlantic. More information available at 866 the number 4 glass 1. And we are here talking about the curfew here on the Mark Steiner Show. What you just heard there was the Ballad of Birmingham, arrangement by Branson Edwards, again, in remembering the four little girls who were murdered in Birmingham, Alabama 50 years ago. Councilman Brandon Scott, Sonia Kumar from the ACLU, Jason Tashia from Advocates for Children and Youth, Dante Wilson, who runs Collinson Square and founder of Reclaiming Our Children Community Project, David Brown, aid to Councilman Carl Stokes, talking about the curfew, 410-319-8888. Very quick thing we're going to say, and then we're going to go right back to the phones here.
Well, I just want to bring up the point that this curfew is just an update. You know, all of these issues.
Why do you think we need an update?
We need an update just simply because if kids have to be in school at 8 o'clock in the morning.
But why do you need an update?
Why do you need an update? Because we're saying that it's okay for a young kid that's in 8th, 9th, 10th, 8th, 9th, 6th, 5th, 3rd grade to be out at 11 o'clock in the morning, knowing that young kid has to be basically out of their house probably by 7 to be to school. And I will add
that. I just question whether or not it's the government's place
to do that. But we already have a curfew. We already have a curfew.
So why don't we make that work first?
But what I'm saying is, and even the young people, the young kids that I talked to, I was at a high school last week, and they almost all were in support of this curfew. They said, well, I got to be on the bus by 6 o'clock anyway.
But that doesn't mean anything, really.
What do you mean? It does when you're talking about young
people. America supported segregation doesn't mean I supported it.
No.
I mean, I think the conversation.
We know you didn't support segregation.
I think it depends on sometimes which kids we're talking to. So I work with a drop-in center for youth at risk of homeless youth in the city, and I think that their reaction is probably really different, and I think that they have a lot of concerns about sort of what this means for their interactions with police, and they're already unable or unwilling to sort of report their own victimization to police, and there's no reason to believe that this will be anything.
Yeah, we're asking government to legislate.
But I
want to
get to the schooling,
which we already legislated.
But I think I want to get to
You legislated, but now it's going to be conveniently enforced. And there's been an attack on kids for a while now. I mean,
we've been enforcing the kids who are not finishing school. Dropouts are at its lowest. Yeah. Our high school graduation rates are at its highest. So that it's not the correlations aren't adding up.
For those that are in school, the correlation is not adding up here.
I have to get to the phones. Sonia, finish your thought. We'll open the phones.
I just want to get at the sort of the intentions thing, right? Because I've heard a couple of different things. I've heard it's about getting kids ready for school, and I just question whether that a curfew is the best way for us to do that, or if that's even the most reasonable way. If it's about making kids safer, I think again we've talked about other ways in which we can do that.
And then there are other people saying it's about juvenile crime,
These are all different purposes.
Let me get two quick callers in here. 410-319-8888. Ray, you're on the air, and we can bring Councilwoman Holt on the air for very quick thoughts. We only have like 5 or 6 minutes left in the segment. Ray, go ahead.
First of all, I thank everybody for coming. You know, I've been sitting here listening. Dante, this is Ray Cook, man.
Hey, Ray.
And, you know, man, I'll tell you the truth. I support the bill. Well, again, there's loopholes in it. I think that, you got to start going back to what this is a new day and time. The crack epidemic has really ruined our people, but this is nothing new when it comes to young people being on the street. But one thing that I don't want you to dismiss is that mother that was on the phone, that she would rather have a police bring her kid. It don't necessarily have to be a police, first of all, because that's another story we'll get into later. But I just went through a family that just buried 3 people in the last 3 months. You know what I mean? What do you tell a mother who has lost 3 sons to the street, all under the age of 17? Then you tell me, how do you deal with that? And I mean, you have to look at the conditions that create these things.
Okay, Ram, so we're almost out of time. And as we talked together on Friday, you're on the show this week as a guest as well to get you on here. And we'll bring some of the folks back to continue this. Let's get another quick thought here from Councilwoman Holton.
Good morning. Thank you, Mark. Good morning to all the guests, Councilman Scott and David Brown from Councilman Stokes' office.
Good morning.
You know, since this introduction of the bill has come up, I've had a lot of time to think more about it than I did in signing on to it. And I do have some concerns, and I'm going to put it in 3 points: education, enforcement, and economics. And I do think that curfew is something that, number one, has not been enforced to the extent that it should have been. And, Mark, you remember when Councilman Ken Harris introduced the truancy center, and we kind of had a little bit of money there to deal with it, and it was starting to take some legs. You don't hear anything about what's going on with that anymore. So when we talk about kids getting to school and staying in school, education. Here's a fact. You don't know what you don't know until someone informs you of it. And so from an education perspective, I think that we have a lot of parents that are not effectively parenting their kids, not because they don't want to, but because they don't know how to. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk about one of the panelists talked about maybe it should be called a family and youth development center, which sounds a whole lot better than a diversionary center, because we have to be mindful of the language and the things we put in place. The retired officer that was on the line that talked about enforcement, and that is a major concern I have right now. Do we just keep putting more money in the police department to pick up kids that already have a stigma when they see those blue and white cars and those flashing lights that they're going to scatter and run?
So, Helen,
the officer said, we need to build alliances for them to feel like the police is someone who cares about them and is not looking to lock them up or take them home and fine. So here's the economics. You're talking about kids in lower neighborhoods with lower income that don't have the money to pay whatever it is and may not have the time to show up at the diversionary center to get what they already know, but how can they do what they have to do when they got to work to provide for their family? So there are a lot of issues.
Hello, I'm sorry, I have to jump in because we are out of time in this segment. And let me just say this. I know that before we all run, when does this bill come up for a vote?
We haven't even scheduled a hearing yet.
Haven't scheduled a hearing. Mm-hmm. When do you think the hearing will be?
Probably within the next month.
So what I'd like to propose, I'd like to continue this conversation on the air. Bring Helen on. Ray Cook on the show, and you all come back again, figure out how to make in a longer segment so everybody has a chance to really have a say here in a deeper way. I think this is a very important conversation, nuanced in terms of our differences and where we stand. And I want to thank all of you for taking your time with the citizens of Baltimore today to deal with this really important issue. Councilman Brandon Scott, always good to have you in the studio.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate
thank you for having me.
Willingness to come here. Sonia Kumar, thank you for all the work you're doing, for being here as well. And same with you, Dante Wilson.
Thank you.
You two do a yeoman's work in this community. It's good to have you both here. And I just met Jason Tashia, but I'm sure you do as well, as Advocates for Children and Youth, and David Brown.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, brother, for being here as well and
appreciate
continuing
it.
This conversation. We're going to take a break. When we come back from this break, we're going to meet Morgan graduate David Talbert, filmmaker, playwright, more. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And we will come back to this in the coming week or more for a very special conversation and bringing other forces in as well. Thank you all.